Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How have creative forces shaped where and how we live in the 21st century? And how well positioned are innovative people to withstand the challenges of a battered economy? Richard Florida's best-selling 2002 book, The Rise of the Creative Class, had a huge impact on how American business and civic leaders think about the value of creativity as an economic force that continues today, so that cities around the country are now actively working to attract highly educated professionals who work in media, the arts, science, medicine, and technology. 10 years later, he has updated the book with new data about creative metropolitan areas and their resilience to tough economic times and the challenges of class conflict and inequality. And he concludes that the best way to raise standards of living for those at the bottom is to find ways to creatify virtually every job. Richard Florida is director of the Martin Prosperity Institute at the University of Toronto's Rotman School of Management and senior editor for The Atlantic. His newly updated book is called The Rise of the Creative Class Revisited. Richard, welcome back to Think.
Oh, it's great to be back with you, Chris, and thanks so much for having me on.
So you've been writing about the creative class and its influence since your first book on the subject, and in fact, before your first book on the subject. What, besides the round number of 10 years, made this the right time to go back and update the original work?
Well, you're so kind to trace the lineage of my work before Rise of the Creative Class. Many people think my career started there, and in fact, I have been working with another fellow, Martin Kenney, a professor at the University of California, Davis, since the very inception of my career in the early to mid-1980s, trying to figure out what this new phase of post-industrial capitalism would look like. So there's a long lineage before that book, but fortunately, none of my other books before that were successful. I wrote three, but it was, and it created something of an interest in my work. And the publisher, Basic Books, came back to me a couple of years ago and said, you know, your book has stimulated so much of a dialogue, perhaps controversy, criticism, back and forth. It's had such a big impact on not only the way we think about cities, but the way cities try to make themselves more attractive, engaging, creative places. Would you like to update it? And at that point, I said, sure. And my thought was, you know, we just update the statistics and talk about some of the debate. But when I dug into it, it became clear to me that, one, I wanted to be on record responding to various dialogues, important dialogues that I've had over the past decade. But two, and you were so kind to mention this, that there was a suite of material that was going to be in the first edition of the book. It ended up being in a follow-up book, Flight of the Creative Class, on the inequality in our society and how our society was becoming more divided. So I really then decided to add five wholly new chapters dealing with the class division in our society, dealing with rising inequality, also dealing with the globalization of the creative economy and the creative class. So all those things came together to convince me and our team to update the material in the book, but also to write a kind of new book that we call Rise of the Creative Class Revisited.
So for people who might not know the original work, define for us who belongs to the creative class and how those workers can be further divided into the super creative core and simply creative professionals.
Sure. You know, my notion coming in that sort of motivates all of this work was people before me had done a very good job of talking about the rise of a post-industrial economy, the rise of an information age, the internet economy, the service economy, and then, you know, the great work of Peter Drucker on the knowledge economy. I had been talking about that, calling it a learning economy, a new style economy, a new economy. But when I was writing the book, something struck me, and I think folks listening in will find this to be of some interest. It struck me that when Marx was writing his work on the birth of capitalism and the rise of the new class structure when we move from an agrarian to an industrial society, he said that the proletariat, the working class, was not only creating value and wealth and having that ripped off by the capitalists. He said the way they did that was something very interesting that all human beings shared. The workers worked with their physical or manual labor. And he said that physical or manual labor is what differentiates human workers from other species. Hmm. When I was writing the original book, Rise of the Creative Class, it dawned on me that it wasn't simply knowledge that we acquire or information that we create or technologies that we build. The real thing that human beings share is this innate, inextricable, part of our very humanity that we all have is this creativity. So I argue that every single human being is creative, and I think that's really key. And then in looking at the statistics on the new class structure with my colleague Kevin Stolarik here at the Martin Prosperity Institute, we found that, in fact, about a third of the workforce, which I think is a shockingly high statistic, about a third of the workforce is primarily engaged in work that uses their thinking, their knowledge, their intellectual labor, their creativity. And just to answer your question specifically, we could divide that group into two components. The super creative core, which are basically scientists, techies, innovators, researchers, and then also artists, designers, musicians, and people who are culturally creative. And then there's the creative professionals, the management and business and healthcare and legal workers. Around them all together, and it's about 40 million Americans, about a third of the workforce, that take home about $2 trillion in wages and salaries, about half of all wages and salaries paid. So that's the definition of the creative class.
How does diversity feed the creative class?
Well, you know, this became in many ways the most controversial item in the whole dialogue. We have to scroll back 10 or 15 years and look at the state of our cities and the state of what we call urban policy or economic development practice. Basically, what was in the environment was that a government, a mayor, an economic development official would try to lure a company to a town, offering tax incentives, abatements, all sorts of subsidies, outlandish subsidies many times. And then, of course, there was a shift a little bit, you know, in the 90s to growing technology clusters. But you know, what the real breakpoint for me was talking to my students then at Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh and asking them where they wanted to live. And it became clear to me that this young group, very, very small group at first, wanted to live not only where they could get a good job, but where they could be an exciting, thriving, creative, culturally engaged place with other young people and bustle. And I said to myself, you know, this economic development field, they're talking about companies, but no one's talking about people. And it quickly became clear to me, it didn't take rocket scientists to figure this out, that our demography in America were changing. Half of us happen to be single. Only a quarter of us have a Leave It to Beaver family, nuclear family, two parents with children under 18 in the home. The complexion of our society was changing in terms of ethnicity, race, you know, foreign immigration. And then, of course, you know, back then it was seemed outlandish to talk about sexual orientation. But I had a colleague named Gary Gates. He's now at UCLA in the Williams Institute. He was working on the location of gay men. And it's a funny story how we got to diversity. We met in the hallway one day, and Gary said, I hear you've been looking at knowledge workers. I didn't call them the creative class then. He said, well, I've been looking at where gay men happen to be located, and we looked at our list, and, you know, it was San Francisco, Boston, Seattle, Austin, you know, go down the list. They were the identical list, maybe slightly differently organized. So I then began to see that this thing called the diversity of our demography was critical, and I simply named it the three T's, figuring my mom, who beat into me the three R's, reading, writing, and arithmetic, the three T's, that in order to grow and thrive, a community needed to do three things. It needed to have technology, the first T, invest in R&D, build technology companies, have great technological universities. Second, it needed to have talent, needed to have good school systems, primary, secondary. It had to have good universities to develop talent. But thirdly, it needed tolerance, because in order to attract the people who grow this economy, they come in all shapes and sizes, all ethnicities, all nationalities, all sexual orientations, all family types. And I said, that's what economic development should do. It should be about attracting people from across the spectrum, and the places that do the best have just that characteristic. So diversity is really important and probably the single most controversial thing that I wrote about in the book.
So talk about this, Richard. Why have certain creative hubs formed organically in the past? And is that somehow more valuable than a city and a group of leaders coming together and saying, we really want to enhance what we have to offer people and recruit by creating a sort of creative core?
Well, I'm a big believer in asset-based economic development, that you don't simply try to become the next Silicon Valley and end up being a Silicon Nowhere, that you look at your assets. And in fact, that's what the three T theory is about pragmatically. It basically says, take a look at your technology base, your talent base, and your tolerance, and figure out where you stack up. And the book is filled with ratings and rankings, and we make those widely available on our website, and we help cities understand that. But we also say that you can look at the occupational. It's kind of a techie, wonky point for folks listening in, but you know, many people talk about their industrial base and their industrial clusters. What we said is, that's great, and you should look at that. You should look at, you know, whether you have a biotech, a software, an auto, whatever it is, service economy. But you should also look at the jobs and occupations. So we invented, Kevin Stolarik, really, my colleague, invented this way of looking at your occupational through the lens of this creative class and your clusters of jobs and skills in your own economy. And in that sense, I think it's mainly organic. I think that this happens mainly organically, that you can't change your economic complexion, but you can nudge it along. And that's what the book says. It says, don't do these big things that don't pay off. And in economic development, we've had, I say, moratorium on mega projects. We don't need more convention centers with public money, more stadiums with public money. We don't need to bribe companies with public money. Do the small things that will stay in your community. Build quality of life. So protect your green assets. Make sure you invest in your parks. These are things people of all range of work and demographic types enjoy. You know, strengthen up your universities and colleges. Invest in your schools. But the one thing that kept coming out in our work and in Gallup surveys over the course of the past decade, it wasn't just low crime rates and good schools and good pipes and infrastructure that gave people an identity and an emotional attachment to their town. It was the social and cultural offerings. It was this quality of place. It was this soul of the community. And in fact, having parks and green space and bike lanes, which are really cheap to do, the small little things that made a great quality of place, those were the things that not only generated a creative class, but made everybody in the community more attached to the place, more likely to recommend it to friends, to want to bring their family there. So I'm really advocating, after my great, you know, idol and mentor, Jane Jacobs, doing small things right. Economic development doesn't have to break the bank. If you build your community, do the small things, spread your bets, and build on your assets, you can have some success.
I do think it's interesting that a vibrant city center is such a draw, even for workers who might live outside the city center, whose jobs might be elsewhere. People still want to know that they can go to this place.
Well, it's so funny. You know, I'm 54. So, and I was born in Newark, New Jersey, a city that's celebrating the 45th anniversary of the 1967 riots this year. And I actually went to Newark to look at the exhibit. And by the late 1960s, of course, most people were convinced that urban centers were dead. They had to be propped up with damaging urban renewal projects. You had to build convention centers, big homogeneous boxes. You had to, you know, try to lure companies or put a fence around the university. And by 1975, the year I was graduating high school, of course, New York was proclaimed dead. New York City was proclaimed dead. Fiscal crisis, you know. The United States, to Mayor Koch, drop dead. We're not going to bail you out. And if you thought about 1975 or 1976, cities seemed like they were on the outs. It was the rise of the suburban park, suburban office areas. We called them the Nerdistans. In the first book, it's the Nerdistan. Everyone's moving to the Nerdistan, the tech companies, everything. Everyone's out in the suburbs. Well, I began to see this trend, you know, in the late 1990s, always being an urban person, always living in cities. But I began to see this trend not just in New York and San Francisco and Boston and Chicago. You began to see this percolation. And what's amazing is how much that has progressed in the past 10 years. Our cities are clearly back.
Richard Florida is with us. He's director of the Martin Prosperity Institute at the University of Toronto's Rotman School of Management and a senior editor of The Atlantic. His book, which has been revised, is called The Rise of the Creative Class Revisited. It's an updated version of his 2002 bestseller. If you'd like to join us, we will take calls in a moment at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration is now open. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Richard Florida joins us on the phone today from the University of Toronto's Rotman School of Management, where he is director of the Martin Prosperity Institute. We're talking about his new book, The Rise of the Creative Class Revisited. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. So let's get down to brass tacks here, Richard. How did the economies of America's most creative metropolitan areas in 2012, after what we've been through, compare with those of the least creative regions?
Well, I think we've seen, you know, what my dear friend Bill Bishop long ago called the big sort. We see a country which is sorting itself by red and blue, by the kind of work people do, by the kinds of activities they engage in, and if anything, I see a growing gap between the leading centers of creativity and economic resilience and those that are falling further behind. But one of the things I've learned in doing this revised edition, you know, in the first edition, big cities, well, maybe not the biggest cities, you know, New York, Chicago, and L.A. did fine, but towns like Seattle or San Francisco or south of San Francisco, the Silicon Valley, Austin, Texas, these are the kinds of places that did very, very well. Now, many of those communities have tended to do well again, but what we've seen over the course of this crisis is the incredible rise of what I would call university and college towns. On our overall creativity index, Boulder, Colorado, took first place, besting many much bigger metros. But what was particularly interesting to me was Ann Arbor, Michigan, you know, in the shadow of Detroit that has been very hard hit by the economic crisis, the deindustrialization of our country. Ann Arbor, Michigan was number four. So I think that what we're finding is that really it's places that have large universities, particularly land-grant universities, maybe multiple universities, that they are becoming incredibly resilient. We actually compared, you know, the unemployment rates to a state's university or college town to its major commercial and economic hub. And in every case, the unemployment rates in the university or college town was much lower. So I think we do have a new economic face of America, and it partly is bi-coastal, as the coasts have done reasonably well. Obviously, the cities that we're trying to grow, I call it growth without growth, and the cities that we're trying to stimulate growth by building houses but had no economy, you know, sprawling out, just trying to stimulate a construction and real estate flipping, they've been hard hit. Many of the old manufacturing centers, particularly the smaller towns, but some of those like Pittsburgh and now even Detroit, you know, we did a great film series, video series on Atlantic cities about how Detroit's creative class is being engaged. But those more diverse metros and the college towns are the ones that look very resilient. So I fear that if we don't get with this, our country becomes more divided. And the election, this upcoming election, is just, you know, one instance of that.
Yeah, let's talk about that. In these places that have remained vital or have gained vitality because of the presence of a really significant creative class, does that vitality extend to people who are, you know, driving buses and taking tickets at movie theaters and jobs that we don't consider creative?
It's a very complicated question, and I can give you two answers, and I will be, for folks listening in, I will be writing more at Atlantic Cities about this. What we find is that in general, and I'm saying this in a very broad brush, if you're in a place with a large concentration of the creative class, or equally, another measure that's quite closely related to that, a large concentration of adults that have graduated college, in general, everyone does better. The creative class makes more money, the highly educated people make more money, and it pulls up everyone. And one of the things we can come back and talk about is I document this service class. The service class is more than 60 million Americans who do low-wage, low-skill service jobs. They prepare our food, they serve us in retail shops, take care of us in hotels, take care of our kids, our aging parents, our janitors, and so forth. But all of the wages across the board go up. The problem is when you add in housing costs. When you add in housing costs, even in a very expensive place like Manhattan or Boston, San Francisco or Washington, D.C., Los Angeles, the creative class more than covers the housing costs because their salaries are higher, and they have even more left over to spend. That is not true of the service class. The service class, even though wages are higher, have to bear much higher housing costs, and that's why so many service people have to endure brutal commutes. So looking at this, the creative class lifts wages, but they put so much pressure on real estate markets that service people, even though they're paid more, end up being a little bit behind the eight ball in creative class centers.
So does that create equate to tension between the different classes?
Well, I mean, you need look no farther than Occupy Wall Street. Mm-hmm. I talk about that movement. I said in the original edition that the class conflict in our society would no longer be primarily based in a factory. It would be conflicts over place and community. You need look no farther than the riots that erupted in London. I talk a lot about them in the book. In fact, the FT, when it reviewed the book, that's what it really, Financial Times, it pointed out my ability to discuss the riots. And then you look at, you know, Americans wouldn't guess, but I live in, well, you might guess because you said, but I live in Toronto now, a city noted for equity and health care and social justice. But, you know, in Toronto, the community elected a very right-wing, almost Tea Party-like populist mayor. I've been on record calling him the most anti-city mayor in modern civilization. And he was there because many people thought the downtown crowd, the yuppies, young people, the public sector workers who he said were on the gravy train, what's in it for me? So I very much see this urban divide and this divide within cities becoming the critical divide that we face. And in my book, I say that we need a new creative social compact. We need a new social compact for our time. And that must be prevalent on investing in and harnessing and paying people for the use of their creativity, whether that be in manufacturing or on the farm or in services. We have to upgrade all work. This divide of the haves and the have-nots can no longer continue. And that's a big part of why I wanted to write the new revised edition.
Question here from Dan in Arlington. Dan wants to know what your thoughts are on cities like Arlington, which, as you may know, is between Dallas and Fort Worth, where, as Dan writes, a strong Tea Party movement has meant no new parks, no arts funding, closing libraries, no bike trails, etc. Many people think this will make Arlington wither and die in the future since there is no reason for young people to move there.
Well, Chris, thank you, and thanks to the caller. I know Arlington very well. And the reason I know Arlington very well is I've become very close friends with Jim Spaniolo, who's the president of the University of Texas at Arlington. In fact, Jim invited me to come as a visiting researcher over the past 2 years with my team to take a look at how to strengthen Arlington and the entire Dallas-Fort Worth-Arlington region. And we made up a slide presentation looking at the assets of the region. I think Jim and I, we wrote a piece for the Dallas Morning News. I think the big asset, of course, in the area is the university, and the university is going up. Now, we said the real challenge for the greater region is that Dallas, Fort Worth, Arlington doesn't really have one of these spectacular universities, like the University of Michigan or Michigan State, you know, like the North Carolina University and North Carolina State. And one of the things we concluded, an interim conclusion of our work, is that not only does the community have to strengthen its strong parts of its economy, but the entire region has to really focus on upgrading those universities. We did find, and a young faculty member at the University of Texas at Arlington actually wrote about this at Atlantic Cities, we found some Tea Party opposition to our inquiry. So we were looking at this. In fact, one time we were doing a symposium on campus, there was the notion that maybe the Tea Party would pay us a visit. Of course, they didn't. But this young faculty member at the University of Texas at Arlington wrote about this. So I think yes, and that I think with that we can't blame that. We need to take the high road. The creative people, the creative class, university leaders, political leaders have to show that everyone can benefit. Because if we don't show that the creative class and harnessing the creativity of everyone can benefit people and make a stronger community, people are going to say, stop it, it's not benefiting me, I want to go back, stop spending the money. But I think in the book I say the creative class has to engage this, the universities have to engage this, because if not, I shudder to think, as the caller, writer noted, I shudder to think if our cities become so divided, how they will be hampered by this.
So tolerance, that tolerance in the three T's has to extend to political tolerance for differing opinions.
Well, this is why I was so happy that Mike Bloomberg, you know, and I think some mayors on the left saw this Chick-fil-A thing, and they said, oh, you know, the Chick-fil-A CEO, he made a stupid comment about not supporting gay marriage. We're going to ban them. And Mike Bloomberg said, that's crazy. And I said the same thing on Twitter. Everyone has the right to free speech. If you don't want to buy a Chick-fil-A, don't buy a Chick-fil-A. But I think on both sides, and particularly I think on the progressive left, where I would consider myself more on the left of the political spectrum, I think there has to be tolerance there too, and there has to be open-mindedness there too. My hunch is what's happening is that the center cities that are thriving, you know, filled up with creative class people, gay populations, immigrants who in the perception of others are doing better, young people who don't seem to be working, you know, this average American worker is saying, well, what happened to me? You know, I'm falling further behind. We're working two jobs. We can't afford our house. We're in foreclosure. We have to rent someplace. So I think that one of the big things we need to do is have a progressive vision of an inclusive future. But if we paint ourselves into this culture war, political war, you're in the suburbs, you're conservative, you're in the city, you're left, we don't get along. And I don't blame, you know, I'm one of the few people that doesn't, I saw this coming, you know. You could just see the handwriting on the wall. And those of us who are at advantage, those of us who live in great cities, those of us who are members of this creative economy, we've got to put a hand out and a hand up for everybody. And that's the way we're going to heal our society, by valuing everyone's creativity and showing people that we can have a new social compact and a new vision of the future that everyone can be a part of, not just the chosen creative few.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phones now to John in Arlington. Hi, John.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question. I'm a teacher, and you've been talking a lot about the regions that are more ubiquitous with these cultural centers. But everywhere you go, you find teachers, and I tend to think that teachers would be a part of this creative class. And I was just wondering what the author's opinion on that is, as well as especially here in Arlington, like you just mentioned, where there is kind of a social divide between politics and, you know, things like that. So thank you very much.
Thanks for your call.
John, teachers are very much a part of the creative class. They're one of the largest segments. They're part of that creative professional group I talked about. And then obviously, you know, and I've talked about that in another book that I wrote, that I'm not one of these people who blames the teachers. You know, there's so much of this going on in our society. What I said, and I worked with Gallup on this, when teachers are engaged in their work, when teachers can thrive, the classrooms thrive. So I think making teachers in our educational system, the hard point is, of course, that our education system, no matter the great creative efforts of teachers, our system was born out of the mass production factory system. So our schools, with learning to the test and rote memorization and all of this, have become more education factories. So I'm a big fan of Sir Ken Robinson, you know, the Englishman. He has the most viewed TED Talk ever. You should look at it, folks, where he says that our schools have to become part of nourishing the creativity of young people rather than squelching it out of them. So I think the big transformation we need to build in our society is to empower teachers to use their creativity, to empower teachers to work with the creative contributions of their students, and to really transition our schools from education and learning vehicles to vehicles for really harnessing and motivating that human creativity that lies deep within each and every one of us.
We tend to get very alarmed when we look at the performance of students in other countries around the world and realize that we have fallen in the rankings. Is there a particular set of criteria we need to apply to interpreting those results that might either calm us down or lead us in the right direction in terms of how to reformulate our own schools?
Believe it or not, I'm not that worried. I mean, having come from a Catholic school in New Jersey, going to a state college, Rutgers College, on a public Garden State scholarship, I think that the United States still, and we have many problems, my Lord, we have many, but as someone who's lived outside the country in Canada, another great country, by the way, for the past 5 years, there is something in the United States, even with our ineffective school system, these factories for learning, that somehow is permeable. Now, it's not perfect, and there's too much dropouts. And I always say the smartest kids I ever met were the kids back in Newark and North Arlington, the working class kids, who didn't smarter than the kids I met at Harvard, a student at MIT or wherever, University of Toronto. But I still think that America, there's something about America that harnesses this creative energy. And it's not just the scientists, you know, the Bill Gates, the Steve Jobs, the high-tech entrepreneurs who dropped out of college. It's our ability to create new musical forms from our lowest income, most, you know, guys like Jay-Z and the invention of, from Louis Armstrong to Jay-Z, the invention of new musical forms from the bottom of our society. I think that our schools are screwed up. Yes, we could do better. Yes, we could align, and it would just be so much better. But I still think, you know, my friend Vivek Wadhwa, who's looked at entrepreneurship across the world, still says, The engineers and technologists that come out of American universities are just more entrepreneurial. Yes, we may fall behind in science and math. Yes, we have to do better. Our kids need to know geography. They need to know all this stuff. But I think the great advantage of America is that it is this very permeable, porous, diverse place. And then the other advantage is that even as our kids are falling behind tragically, we are still able to attract the best and brightest kids from all over the world to do things that maybe, you know, and maybe Americans don't want to do high-level math or computer science or software engineering. But boy, oh boy, there are young people all over the world who are streaming into the United States wanting to do those jobs. And that's why immigration is so important to us. So it's a strange thing to say that despite ourselves and despite all the screwy things we do, America looks to me more creative, more innovative, more dynamic than I can't see China replicating this. I can't see the Soviet Union, the other BRIC, replicating this. I think India and Brazil have a little bit of this thing. Canada certainly does, Australia too. But I think America remains the most creative place on the planet. And it's something that's because our society has so many problems, it seems almost counterintuitive, but it's true.
Richard Florida is with us. He is senior editor of The Atlantic and author of the new book, The Rise of the Creative Class Revisited. It's an updated version of his 2002 book. If you'd like to join the conversation, we have lines open at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration is now open. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Richard Florida. He's director of the Martin Prosperity Institute at the University of Toronto's Rotman School of Management. His new book is called The Rise of the Creative Class Revisited. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Richard, I went to high school in El Paso, Texas, and went back there and worked for a few years after graduating from college. Very fond of the place, have lots of friends and relatives still there, but it's a city that struggles with brain drain. Can you talk about what you recommend to cities that tend to lose creative talent, what they need to do to keep their best and brightest from moving away?
Well, I know El Paso really well. After I wrote Rise of the Creative Class, I was invited to give a speech. Met the mayor, the city manager, local leaders, and we actually did an exercise in El Paso where we worked with 20 or 30 dynamic, diverse city builders to think through what El Paso could do. And the first thing that struck me and struck us and where there was tremendous resonance is that El Paso was part of a global city region, you know, tied to Mexico, and we actually developed a set of strategies for joint cultural activities, joint research activities, and to build up the creative energy and economic clout of El Paso. So my advice to El Paso is that you have to understand your assets. El Paso was a commercial center for the border region. It was able to attract a variety manufacturing companies that were doing work on both sides of the border, some service industries. It had some thriving elements of its creative cultural scene. So my is not try to replicate or just draw in and use incentives, but to work hard on those assets that any city has. In Detroit, you know, the whole idea of leveraging the great universities near Detroit, Michigan State and the University of Michigan, of attracting and leveraging talent across the region, using the airport as an addition, or focusing on building up design capabilities that were originally oriented around auto, but now cut across a variety of industries, and, of course, building stronger, more robust neighborhoods in the core. So all of those things, but it's really economic development today isn't a big bang. You know, it's not one thing that's going to solve your problems. It's really doing many, many, many things on parallel fronts, building up your talent base, investing in technology, and making sure you're a diverse and open-minded community with a strong investing in green space, quality of place. But the turnaround, a hard-hit community, a community that has been shell-shocked by deindustrialization or a city of sprawl and speculation as there are in the Southwest, that turnaround process is more than a generation. You know, I saw it happen in Boston in the 70s, but that they were initially hit in the late 40s and 50s. Pittsburgh is going through it now, but it took its body blow in the 70s and 80s, and Detroit is early on into it, but it takes a good generation to really begin to see the fruits of a lot of small things and hard work on building up those organic assets that are in every community.
We have an email here from John in Oak Cliff who asks, what do you mean by the phrase social compact, and what are the basic features of the one you propose?
Oh, that is, thank you. That is such a great question. So every time we have a major change in our economy, like the shift a couple of hundred years ago from the agricultural economy to the industrial economy, or today from the industrial economy to the knowledge or creative economy, we get as a result of that a terrible inequality. The people who are part of that new economic system, their boats rise. Other people are left further and further behind. Our society looks like it's being torn in two. So about after a century, it took a century after the rise of the industrial economy, during the New Deal in America, but of course in Northern Europe and Scandinavia and Canada, people said we need a new social compact. We need to make sure that not only are the industrialists making money, we need to make sure these manufacturing workers, like my dad, who worked in an eyeglass factory, that they can make money, support their families, buy houses, and buy the stuff coming off the assembly line. So during the New Deal and after the war, we forged a new social compact, which said that workers would have the rights to join unions, that unions would have the right to demand higher wages. We created social security for old age, unemployment insurance, you know, welfare for people who were destitute. Well, that worked well. We created a middle class, but now our economy's changed again. We need a new social compact, but one that's based on the principles of the creative economy. So in my view, in that particular, that every human being has the right to fully develop their creative talent and to be justly rewarded, whether you work in manufacturing, whether you work on the farm, or whether you provide services. And I think the one thing our nation has to do is get workers in the service businesses, these low-skill workers who, you know, take care of us in hotels, clean up our offices, take care of our kids, prepare our food in a fast food joint or a restaurant. The 60 million Americans who do that work and are making 20 or 30 grand a year max, we've got to make sure that they can have better jobs. And the way to do that is to engage them more in their work, involve them more in their work, let them be part of the innovative solution like we did in our factories, and then pay them more for their efforts. So that's where I think the new social compact has to be, pulling up the bottom, and particularly the 60 million service workers who do so much for our society, they have to be given a living wage, and the way to do that best is to involve them more in their jobs. Their wages will rise, productivity will rise, the companies will be more competitive, and America will be more prosperous.
This is what you call creatifying every job.
We have to creatify every job, and this is the frustrating thing in America today. You know, if you look at our unemployment rate, 8%, but maybe double that when you take discouraged workers who have stopped looking for work. When you look at, you know, the proposals for job creation coming out of both parties, and I'm an Obama supporter, but, you know, they're talking about we're going to bring some manufacturing jobs back. It's better. It's cheaper. We can bring some factories back, give people a good job. Whoa, we're not going to bring back more than a couple of hundred thousand new factory jobs. It's a drop in the bucket. 130 million Americans work. Oh, we're going to educate people better and put more through university. Well, we already said a third of us work in the creative class. What about the other half of our workforce that is toiling, doing two and three jobs in a family with kids working? Reminds me of my father in the Depression, who said it took nine family members working in factories and retail shops to make a living wage for their family. We have got to creatify service work. We have got to do what we did in manufacturing. We've got to get that work to be more productive. We're going to have a two-tiered society. So we have to have a better go and a new social compact that creatifies everybody's job. And I, for the life of me, what so concerns me is our country, is that conversation is not heard anywhere in national affairs. Now, there are a few mayors and cities trying to do this, but at the national level, I said in the book, the longer the crisis goes on, the smaller the ideas become. And I think we need to look at what this new creative economy is, how to upgrade all jobs, and how to creatify everyone's work, and to give everyone a shot at a good, high-paying, engaged job.
But I know you've heard this criticism before, Richard. There are people who are saying it's not fair. If I am coming up with all the good ideas, if I am in charge of this company or this industry, why should I have to pay any more than I absolutely have to the people at the lowest levels who are contributing labor but perhaps not ideas?
That's exactly what the robber barons said in the 1890s and the 1900s and the 1910s and the 1920s, until Henry Ford gave him a wake-up call, and he said, if we keep down this road, well, people are going to be angry and upset, and it won't be a pretty society. But more than that, if we want to sell cars and we want to sell refrigerators and we want to sell television sets, people have to, or we want to spot them to buy houses and fill them up with all that stuff, they've got to make enough wages to create demand, right? We have a crisis of demand in our society today. That's why they want a stimulus and use monetary policy. We have a crisis of demand. Our economy can't get going. So here's what I think. It makes no sense to cut off the top. It's ludicrous that the incentives for companies to innovate, for the Steve Jobses of the world, or the Bill Gateses of the world, or the Mark Zuckerbergs of the world, that's what's great about America. If you're going to go out and create something, this brand-new creative destruction innovation, more power to you. But we've got to do something for folks at the bottom, and the way to do that is to reward them for engaging themselves. And the studies show it. When service workers are more engaged in their work, when they're paid a little better, when they can use their brains on the job, the janitor who knows how the building works and can help upgrade its environmental efficiency and energy efficiency, the service worker who knows how to give you better customer service, those in the hotels who are making the hotel run more smoothly, when you engage workers and pay them more, they give more back. And most importantly, we've got to get demand up. We've got to get consumption up. And yes, I think it means that all of us will have to pay a little more. So for this person who cuts our hair, or where we buy our prepared foods, or when we go to a restaurant, but that's what we did in the 30s and 40s. We decided as a society we'd pay a little more for our cars, we'd pay a little more for our refrigerators, we'd pay a little more for our washer dryers, so that the people who worked in those factories could also buy the same things. And I always say, what's more important to you, the car, the refrigerator, the air conditioning unit, the television set, all made offshore, by the way, or is it the person who takes care of your aging parent, who takes care of your kid in daycare, who prepares your food and hopefully will make you healthy food, takes care of the building space you work in? To me, it seems a no-brainer that we all pay a little more. Service workers are more engaged. They make a little more money. Our economy gets more demand, and we start to get off on the right track again. To me, we're going to have to sacrifice a little, but the sacrifice is worth it in terms of long-run economic growth.
Let's go back to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Gabriel on the line in Dallas. Hey, Gabriel.
Hey, hi, Chris. Hey, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I think I pretty much agree with your guest and with what he has said. I know at first I had problem with some of the classes that he said could be considered as creative in the society. But before that, more I listened to him, I think it kind of helped me out on that. But just to kind of make a quick comment, that if the society, can really recognize that creativity can come from anyone in the society, and when it does come, people should be recognized as such. For me, as a business owner and as an entrepreneur, when I interview somebody, I don't want them to come on the job to just do the job that I have hired them to do. I want them to tell me what are they going to bring on the table and that is going to add value to the company. So what I'm trying to say is I want them to be creative, and I wanted to make sure that they are well compensated, and I don't care what kind of job they do.
Well, thanks for your call. Richard, I'm assuming that's music to your ears.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, obviously the caller chose to come from another country to the Dallas area to bring his creative energy, his entrepreneurial skill to the United States, and that's what the basis of the theory is, that one of the things that makes a great country or a great region is its ability to be open-minded, open to diversity, open to all this energy. And, you know, the thing that I keep coming back to is everyone points at the Silicon Valley as an in California, the Bay Area, as an example of American ingenuity and American technology. Well, depending on whose estimate you like, anywhere from a third to half of all of those new high-tech wunderkind businesses were founded by someone who wasn't born in the United States. So I think that's the great part of America, and the next part is how do we activate that creativity in the rest of our population, the nearly half of our population that currently isn't seeing that being activated? How do we bring everyone into this? How do we build one creative economy, not two or three, in which everyone can have a go? And I think we'll get there. I think it may take us a generation, and one of the reasons I wanted to write this book is I'd like to see us get there faster. I think we can get there faster if we put our minds to it. We might not have to wait a generation or so to get there.
The pall has lifted a little bit from where it was 2-3 years ago, but can you talk about the effect of the sort of gloomy outlook that many Americans have today on the economy and on the ability that they have as individuals to sort of get out from under the economic problems they've had?
Well, my view is that we have a very good understanding of what causes economic crises, and we tend to give them these names like recessions or depressions or crises. And then we have two things which we think help us get out. One is we kind of think, drawing on this great economist Joseph Schumpeter, that somehow new technological innovations will come about and pull us up. Or on the other hand, you know, taking a nod to John Maynard Keynes, the British economist, that government will provide enough stimulus, it will provide enough help, it will build new infrastructure and to pull us out. What I found, in fact, that's why I call them resets, great resets, not great crises.
By the way, we've got about 15 seconds. Sorry.
Yeah, is that they force people to live and work in a new way. And I think the key to this for people is this movement back to the cities, getting away from big giant houses that take your money, dependence on the car and energy, and a new way of life that is more efficient and healthier and happier. So, and I see that even though we are starting to come out, I see that happening more and more across the country.
Richard Florida is director of the Martin Prosperity Institute and senior editor for The Atlantic. His newly updated version of his widely influential 2002 book is called The Rise of the Creative Class Revisited. Richard, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thanks for having me again. Hope to be back soon.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast every day free online at kera.org/think. Email any comments, questions, or suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.